Once more into the breach, dear friend. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. Am I actually going? Okay. I couldn't hear myself. Once more into the breach, dear friend. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with a very definitely exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach on this, the 28th day of September 2019. Jeff is here alone, and Jake is off. And actually, he went out there to find out if the coast was clear. And he's going to spend the week setting up a tent, camping on the Gulf Coast, and finding out whether it's really clear down there. I asked him, is the coast clear? And next thing I know, he was gone. But you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400, presuming the day is 28 September where you are. Little disclaimer that we have to do. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. And I say SEC-registered, not that they approve or disapprove, because we are registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which means we're what's called a large investment advisory firm, and rather than with the state. So the regulatory agency that supervises us is or regulates us and inspects us is the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. The information that I provide on here and that we provide every week is not considered to be investment advice, despite the fact we're an investment advisory organization and do manage investment portfolios. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their specific investment needs and their specific goals and objectives. And educational information like this can be given generally. Speaking of which, we obtain the information we release on this show and we talk about on this show from sources we believe to be reliable, things like Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Barron's, places like that, and, of course, then the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, two of our favorite bureaucracies in the Labor Department. But we don't warranty or guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any of the information we give you, because we didn't actually gather it directly ourselves. That's not what we do. That's what they do. Let's see. Oh, yes. I'm supposed to tell you that we do not pay for this show, nor does KTM pay us to do this show. We do advertise on KTM, but in the advertisement, we only advertise for the show. So it's one of those peculiar things where we enjoy doing this. Our clients seem to enjoy it, so we keep on doing it, although we've been doing it now for, I think, something like 25 years. We're trying to find the exact date when we started. I know in the mid-1990s we were doing this. So it's closing in on 25 years that we have been doing this radio program. I did it for the first several years alone, and then Jake joined in. And we've been doing it every Saturday since. And do we know why? I'm not completely sure why I get up early on Saturday morning and research and come down here and spend time on the radio, but I do it. Okay, let's all of a sudden my voice went away. I'm not sure what that means.
You're still on.
Okay. Okay. I think it's probably the plug somewhere. Okay. This, it came back, whatever it was. That was interesting. You know, the control board you have there is probably haunted by the ghost. Yeah, I'm speaking to the engineer. That was in the old control board, because the old control board had a bunch of old pots on it that you turned, and there were dead places in there. And I now used to operate that control board because it was the same one I used when I was in high school in 1966. Same identical design. It may have been the same control board. And they had dead places in the volume pot. So I had to potentiometer is what pot stands for, by the way. It's not something you smoke. And this one is starting to develop those little peculiarities, which makes me feel quite at home. Anyway, let's talk about the market for a moment. Again, the telephone number in here, if you want to join with us, is 254-773-1400 if you have any questions or thoughts. This is probably the only talk radio show you'll hear today or for the next several weeks. We were not going to discuss the pluses, minuses, probabilities or improbabilities of impeachment. So you can call and ask about impeachment, but only to the degree that it affects the economy. We are going to stay out of that particular dogfight. The Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index, which is the index we prefer, it's the broadest index that's widely reported, dropped 1.01% for the week. Now, that's pretty serious business because a 1% drop doesn't sound like much, but when you annualize these things, which people tend to do rather readily, that's a 52% drop for the year. And that had it close out at 2961.79. Now, why is that important? Why is that number important? Well, the biggest, obviously, it was during Tuesday, it was up a little above 3,000 and it started dropping back. The reason it started dropping back and the reason we saw a decline this week and the reason the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is virtually at the same level. I mean, it's 1.64% higher than it was 1 year ago Friday. And what does that mean? Well, considering that inflation has been 1.8% over the last 12 months, that means that after you factor in inflation, the market is a little lower than it was a year ago. It's down about 2.2% from its high, which obviously still would have only put it 3.66% above its high a year, above where it was a year ago. And what happened in between is something that is worth bearing in mind. We've seen earnings up since then, and that means the market has gotten actually cheaper because the price-to-earnings ratio is what counts in the market, the ratio between the earnings, the profitability of S&P 500 companies and the actual index level is the measure of how high the market actually is at any given moment, and it's currently between 15 and 17, depending on how you look at it, the forward price-to-earnings ratio, which is normal. And it's a little bit in the low end of normal. It was a little in the high end of normal a year ago. So why hasn't it gone up anymore? And the answer is in a single word, tariffs. And a lot of people have asked me, why isn't my account higher than it was a year ago? Although some of the accounts are higher than they were a year ago, depending on where they're invested. The point is that tariffs extract money from the system. It's important to remember that profitability in any economic system is a result of trading. In other words, it's a result of something being exchanged for something else. If somebody makes a widget out of raw widget material and it costs them a certain amount of money to do that, and then they sell it for a slightly higher amount, then the higher amount they sell it for is their gross profit. And after they get through paying the rest of their expenses and their taxes and everything else, whatever's left over is what's called earnings. Now, the earnings are what drives the economy. Just like if you go to work, what you get in your paycheck is called earnings. You earn that much money. What you do with it after you earn it, that's your business. And what is available after you pay your expenses of living, that's a very important thing in the economy. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But the fact that the market is only up, well, after inflation, it's actually down a little bit from a year ago, is a very significant issue. On average, the market rises about 7% a year over the long term, the stock market. This year, it has effectively risen zero. Why? Well, because the difference in the economic, we've had economic growth. We've had positive economic growth every quarter. We had 3.1% in the first quarter. We had 2.1%, which I think has been reduced to 2% in the second quarter. Third quarter, man, the estimates are all over the place as to what the GDP growth will be in the third quarter, but it looks like it could be 1.5%, maybe as high as 2%, but probably closer to 1.5%. So why is it going down? Why hasn't the market risen? Those are valid questions, and we're going to get to that in the rest of the program. The other thing that's important is the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury declined 21.4 basis points. That's 0.1%. To 1.682. Now, what that means is that since the 90-day Treasury bill is higher than 1.682, we have an inverted yield curve and continue to have an inverted yield curve. Meanwhile, we have a caller on 773-773-1400. So, John, you're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. Been a lot of articles in the Wall Street that consumers and businesses have record debt and your newsletter said that consumers are starting to pay down their debt, which is, I think, a good thing. If businesses are maxed out on their debt, we have this recession coming up, things slow down, what's going to be the impact to businesses with all this debt? I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Good question. Very good question. By the way, the reason we have recessions, ultimately, is two things. One, inventory buildup. Businesses build up inventory, and in many cases, they borrow money to build up the inventory. It was a business that I followed very closely because I was a patron of that business who had some pretty capital-intensive stuff in their business that they bought with the intent of selling at a profit. But most businesses don't buy whatever they buy using cash out of pocket. They borrow the money to buy it. They build it. They sell it for a profit and pay the loan back. Farmers, by the way, tend to do the same thing, which is the story in the Great Depression of mortgages on farms and farmers' credit. And that's the way a capitalist economy works. It'd be kind of nice, a lot of people would think, if we never borrowed any money and we just used our existing capital to grow things, in which case the banks would never pay any interest and people wouldn't save their money at the banks. And it would be basically... That has been tried. It actually was tried a couple of hundred years ago. And it results in an economy that stagnates and eventually just goes away. Another example, by the way, of what happens when you don't borrow money, Dell Computer Corporation, shortly after, not too long after it first went public, long, long ago, I remember that, almost went bankrupt. Not because they weren't selling computers, not because they weren't doing everything they need to do, but because they refused to borrow any money. As a matter of principle, Michael Dell believed that you shouldn't borrow money. So he used existing cash, and he used existing cash to buy a bunch of chips. And so he'd have chips to build his computers going forward. And all of a sudden, the market for chips crashed. And he suddenly found he had to lower the price of his computers. And he was using the chips that he had all this cash invested in and basically getting less money back for the chips than he paid for them. Now, it didn't affect the overall profitability, but it affected his cash flow to the point where he virtually ran out of cash at one point and had to scramble and get Bobby Inman, some of you remember that and some of you don't, to arrange some loans with the money center banks in New York to cover him, or he'd have gone out of business. The same thing happens in many, many places. When you don't borrow enough money in a business, you're setting yourselves up for a cash flow crunch that will put you out of business. And by the way, that has happened almost on a national scale in the last couple of weeks. Is one of the things I want to talk about is the fact that there wasn't enough money being borrowed by the banks, that they basically ran out of cash to fund short-term operations in the United States, things that are needed to keep the situation going. It's important to remember that money in the 21st century is exclusively credit. I want to say that again. Here in the 21st century, money is exclusively credit. It's not gold or silver, and it shouldn't be gold or silver. That would be a disaster. We tried that. In the 19th century, we had multiple depressions because of fluctuations in the price of gold, and our dollar was based on the price of gold. We had no control of the price of gold. The price of gold still fluctuates massively up and down. So if you base your money on gold, your currency has no stability and just is all over the place and can be cornered and can be dumped and can be shorted and can be wrecked. So today, money is credit. If you look on a dollar bill, it says Federal Reserve note. A note is a loan. Basically, when you hold a dollar bill in your hand, you're holding a loan from the Federal Reserve, signed by the Secretary of the Treasury, signed by the Comptroller of the Currency, which means it's good. Full faith and credit of the United States government back it, but it's still a Federal Reserve note. Most money that consumers spend today is spent via a credit card or a debit card, which by definition is a credit charge. Most money is no longer paper, it's no longer metal, it's plastic. But it's based on credit. And so when we get a credit crunch, we can get in a lot of trouble. Now, let's look at the other side of that. Why is there a lot of borrowing going on? There's not a critically large amount of debt in the system. There's more debt than we've ever seen before in the system, but that is not unreasonable because the economy is larger than it's ever been before. The other thing is interest rates are so amazingly low that businesses can carry a lot more debt and not get in trouble because their interest rates on it are very, very low. So what's the problem with that? The problem with it right now is basically twofold, and I'm going to get into this in more detail in the future, but it's one is liquidity, which is the problem that we really need to pay attention to. And the other one is the fact that when we reach a limit on credit, when we reach, and it's not the limit on, it's not the dollar value of credit. That's not what counts. It all depends on the interest rate. If it's a zero interest rate situation, we can develop, you can have a tremendous amount of credit, and it's not a problem and won't be for a long time because you don't have any interest rate on it, so there's no rush to pay it back if you don't have a term situation. Most credit, most loans don't have monthly payments and an amortization. They may require some kind of monthly payment, but business loans don't have an amortization like you have on your credit card or like you have on your mortgage, where you have to pay it off by a certain time. There's a certain period of time over which you pay principal and interest. Most business loans, you just pay the interest, and then you renegotiate the loan at some point in the future. That is the way the vast majority of credit works in the United States. As a matter of fact, a lot of credit card credit works that way with zero interest. If you haven't gotten it, then that means you're not reading your mail. Presuming that you have reasonable credit, you get these offers for zero interest loans. Now, there's generally an interest charge up front. They don't call it that. They just say you pay us 3% or you pay us 7% of the balance of the debt or you pay us whatever percent of the balance of the debt, which is basically interest up front. It's called a fee, though. And for a year, there's no interest on the loan. And people don't realize that if it's a 7% payment up front, you paid 7%. If it's a 3% interest, a 3% payment up front, you actually paid more than 3% because you paid it up front. You paid about 4.5%, basically the way it's calculated. So it's a pretty good deal for the credit card company. And a lot of people like to roll over those zero interest loans and just roll them over again and again and again because there's no, many cases, there's no payment for a year. But when they, every time they roll them over, they get slightly bigger because you're borrowing an additional amount of money. That has a tendency to come bite you at some point. I'm going to get back to that in just a few minutes. But before we go on, let me, again, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here, 773-1400. Let's talk about the yield on the 10-year Treasury a little bit. It declined during the week. 21.4 basis points, which doesn't sound like very much, but it's down to 1.68%. And a few weeks ago, a caller came in, do you think we're going to see 2% before we see 4%? Well, obviously, we saw 2%. We went right through it and didn't even slow down. We're at 1.68 and falling. I want to emphasize something here. I'm not as smart an economist or as well-educated as economists as the people with PhDs in the Federal Reserve and the people with PhDs who run the major economic reporting services like Moody's that we subscribe to. They are saying that the probability of a recession within the next 12 months is roughly 50-50. Some cases, the Federal Reserve, for example, the official Federal Reserve song right now is there's no indication that there will be a recession in the next 12 months. I can't agree with that, and the reason I can't agree with it, one of the reasons I can't agree with it, and we're going to go into more of those reasons during this program if we have the time to do so, is that since we have had a Treasury yield curve to measure, which has been most of the 20th century and today, certainly in the last half of the 20th century, it was always there and actually goes back into the 1940s. An inverted yield curve has always produced a recession. And when I say inverted yield curve, I'm not talking about a momentary blip of an inverted yield curve. I'm talking about where the 90-day T-bill has a higher yield than the 10-year Treasury note. That has preceded every recession, and it has never provided us with a false alarm. Now, the leading economic indicators are the final arbiter of whether we're going to have a recession. That is 100% accuracy. Once it gets down and stays down for two consecutive months, you can just, at that point, if I were a betting man, I'd be willing to bet we're going to have a recession. And the leading economic indicators are sitting at zero. But the yield curve is the first signal, historically. We got it in very early 2007, we had an inverted yield curve, and it wasn't until a year later that the Great Recession set in. This has happened, and it precedes these recessions rather dramatically. Now, why is there an inverted yield curve before a recession? For one thing, it means that people are fleeing, they're not investing their money where they think it will produce gain for them. Means that there's a lot of money, because the more money that goes into the treasury market, which is a sure thing, which is ultra secure, which is the safest place on earth you can have your money, is in U.S. treasuries. Presuming you hold them to maturity, you can tell exactly what you're going to make or not make. You can't tell what inflation is going to do to it, but you can tell exactly what's going to happen. So when people put a lot of money into treasury securities, that raises the price of the treasury securities. There's a lot of people buying, the price goes up. It's that simple. The more people buy, the higher the price goes. The higher the price goes, the lower the interest rate goes, because the interest rate is a fixed dollar amount. And I'm going to use a rough figure here, not that there are any 10% investments out there. But if you have a $1,000 treasury bond and it's paying 10%, it's going to pay you $100 a year. If the price of that treasury bond, that would be a 10% yield on a treasury bond, which I'm old enough to remember happening back in the late 70s and early 80s. So now the treasury bond, let's just say people poured a lot of money into treasuries. People were buying a lot of treasuries, and the price of that treasury bond doubles. So now, because people are wanting to buy it, it has gone to $2,000 for this bond that you hold. But it's still paying you $100 a year. So that $100 a year is now 5%. So the 10% treasury bond effectively morphed into a 5% treasury bond. Interest rates dropped by 50% because the price of the bond doubled. Now, if you're a purist, that's not exactly correct, down to the hundredth of a percent, but it is very, very close to accurate. So the more money that pours into the U.S. treasury market, the more people who are buying U.S. treasuries, the lower interest rates go. Now, the Federal Reserve cannot control that. The Federal Reserve controls the very, very short-term interest rates that banks loan to each other overnight, which generally sets the tone for the rest of the interest rate curve, but when it inverts, it doesn't. So why does that cause a recession when we get an inverted yield curve? It boils down to this. Banks can borrow money at the overnight rate, is basically as much money as they want up to a point. It's not, and even though they're not borrowing it directly from the Federal Reserve, banks loan to each other, and banks that have excess cash on hand loan to other banks at the overnight rate. So if the overnight rate is 1.5 to 1.75%, for example, say it's 1.5%, and a bank can loan you money to buy a car for 5 years at 5%, they can effectively borrow the money to loan you at 1.5%, and then they can get 5% from the 5-year automobile loan that you made from the bank if you have excellent, superb credit. So the spread then becomes 3.5%. They have a 3.5% profit on that. Obviously, they make very few 5% loans, although they do a few. They probably make it closer to 7, and some of those loans are going to go bad. So what they look for historically in a bank is a 4% spread. If they can borrow the money to loan you, and they can either through people putting in a 5-year CD, and if you look at what a 5-year CD is paying right now, and you look at what a 5-year auto loan, you can see the spread. The problem is, as longer-term interest rates, and by the way, the 5-year happens to be the lowest out there, it's about 1.4 something percent. So if they're trying to borrow money from the Federal Reserve and are from other banks, and it's costing them 2%, which is very typical at this particular moment in time, and the 5-year treasury, the benchmark, is only 1.5%, that means they stand to lose 0.5% a year on that loan. Therefore, the banks are not in any big hurry to make more loans, not to businesses anyway. And they start raising, not interest rates. They can't control the interest rates. That's set by the open market. They start raising the difficulty in getting a loan. You have to be, in essence, perfect credit and have enough money in the bank that you don't need the loan. And then they'll loan you the money. I don't know if you've ever heard the old saying that a banker is somebody who'll loan you an umbrella as long as it's not raining, but at the first sign of rain wants it back. And that's there's a lot of truth to that. So what happens is if the banks hesitate to loan money and they are not interested in loaning money to people, then the economy is going to stop expanding. Because remember I told you the way businesses make profit is they borrow money to do things, then they make a profit on it. We've been talking about the fact for the past several months. We've been talking about the fact that that business investment has been down since probably March. Actually, it started falling off about a year ago, and it is steadily falling off more and more and more. So, business investment, for example, is 1.7% lower at this point than it was a year ago. It was down 0.2% for the month of August alone, which is a 2.4% per year decline in business investment. And some of that investment was committed to years ago, and it's the decline in business investment is accelerating. Remember I told you how business investment occurs. It occurs when businesses go to the bank and they borrow money, and they build a new building and they put a mortgage on it, or they build a new building and they put a floating loan on it, or they buy new computer equipment, or they buy new software. Large-scale purchases like that, a healthy business borrows the money. Why? Because they have a certain amount of cash reserve, and they don't want to touch that cash reserve because some kind of little shock could come along, and they need that cash reserve. It's kind of like nobody that I know of accumulates the full purchase price of a house before they buy a house. Why? Well, because they wouldn't live long enough in most cases. You don't typically accumulate the full purchase price of a car unless you're quite elderly and you have a lot of money. You borrow the money to buy the car. By the way, that makes perfectly good sense. If you're going to keep a car for 5 years and you do a 5-year loan on the car, that means you're paying for it as you use it, which is very efficient. Paying for it up front is like, for example, if you have somebody mow your lawn and paying them for 5 years in advance, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It doesn't make a lot of sense to pay for a car in advance. It doesn't make a lot of sense to pay for a piece of real estate in advance. It's economically far more efficient to borrow the money and pay for it over an extended period of time, during which you're using the thing that you borrowed the money for. That's important. That's an important factor in capitalism. It's an important factor in our economy's ability to grow, and why our economy has grown so much better for so long than any other economy on the earth. Arguably, by the way, of large economies on the earth, the United States capitalist system has done the best job of growing over the last century or so of any system that's ever existed. And that it really rotates around the banks. So let's, again, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And actually, I think we're supposed to do some commercials about now, aren't we? So we're going to do some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out making sure the coast is clear. He took his family down to the Gulf Coast and set up an observation post there. He said he would report back when he got back to see if the coast was clear. And why he did it in this high temperature is beyond my comprehension, but that's him and this is me. As you noted, if you followed us, I was on vacation earlier, and I think he's trying to get even with me. Of course, we were up in Colorado near Wolf Creek Pass where the weather was decidedly cool. We were forced to wear jackets. I mean, suffer, 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 and we never used our air conditioner. Do I miss that? Actually, I was ready after 3 weeks to come back here, which tells you that I'm at least partially insane. We were talking about the markets and we were talking about banking and so on, but let me, before we go on and get more into the economy, course, what I said earlier, we have an inverted yield curve, which indicates we got a recession coming. And we're going to talk about that some more. And the U.S. oil price, West Texas Intermediate, dropped 3.79% this week, closed at $55.91. Now, why did it drop? I think it's actually fascinating that it dropped, because the tensions in the what we used to call the Middle East, we now call Southwest Asia, in the Persian Gulf, have been rising. There's every indication we could still wind up with a war going there. At any moment, we could trigger tankers being sunk, oil refineries being blown up, and a full-scale war. Historically, that would have caused a spike in the price of oil. As a matter of fact, I remember the tanker wars in the 1980s, and they were called the tanker wars. Basically, both sides were shooting at tankers, and it shut down the oil supply coming out of the Persian Gulf. It virtually stopped. And at the first sign that that was going to happen, the price of oil doubled. That would take oil from roughly $60 a barrel, where it was at the beginning of this, to $120 a barrel, which means that if you go to the gasoline pump, your price of gasoline doubled, and there were lines at the gas pump. And it had a distinct effect on the economy, and it was part of the recession that we had during that period, the black swan, as it's called, that triggered the recession of the early 1980s, was that, the oil crisis. Admittedly, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates at the same time. There were a lot of things going on. We had inflation. We had a lot of interesting things going on that weren't too pleasant. We had Ronald Reagan as president. He was very popular. It had nothing to do with politics, but it had to do with the fact that oil, the threat to the oil fields and the threat to the world supply of oil was sufficient, that the price of oil doubled virtually overnight. The price of gasoline doubled overnight, which takes a lot of money out of the economy. In other words, a lot of money that previously was circulating around in the economy suddenly wound up in Saudi Arabia and places like that, or headed to Saudi Arabia and places like that. And the money that you had to spend on going out to eat and buying new things and improving your house and everything else, if you lived at the time, suddenly a much bigger piece of it was allocated to buying gasoline just to get to work. And that resulted in a recession. It's absolutely fascinating to me to note that during that, nothing was as severe as the attack on the Saudi oil refinery. Basically, during the tanker wars, neither side, nobody was shooting at refineries. They were considered sacrosanct. They were off limits because they were too critical to survival of the oil industry in the Persian Gulf. Well, somebody just shot at tankers. Or not tankers, refineries. They shot at refineries and hit. And the price of oil is $55 a barrel, which is rather dramatically, that's 24% lower than it was a year ago. So why is oil 24% lower today, or Friday, than it was a year ago? Again, it's the same thing that I was talking about earlier. In this case, it's tariffs again. Tariffs are pulling money out of the system. We import a lot of stuff from China. Why do we import a lot of stuff from China? Because we do not have the capacity in the United States to make it here. They have the capacity to make it there, and they have the capacity to make it less expensively than we ever could anyway. We are at full employment across the board in the United States. Literally everybody who is trying to hire is reporting the same thing. I heard this over and over again when I was on vacation talking to business owners, that they are unable to find qualified employees. They can't expand even if they wanted to. So if our economy is to expand and we are to sell more stuff at Walmart or Target or wherever, and or cars or whatever, we're going to have to get a lot of the pieces for the stuff that we want to sell made somewhere else. And when the government puts a tax on importing the pieces that are made somewhere else, one of two things happens. Either we stop selling the stuff that's made somewhere else, or the price will go up, or profits are cut, because somewhere that money is going to disappear. And that's what's going on with the tariffs. We now have a roughly 30% tariff on a lot of material, a lot of goods that are imported from China. And if you cruise through Walmart, or since the consumer and consumer purchases are 70% of our GDP, and the biggest seller to consumers in the United States today is Walmart, you can get a real good feeling for what's going on and what's likely to go on in the future just by going through Walmart and looking at tags. You go through Walmart and you see how many things that are in Walmart are made in China, that are reasonably priced, that are priced to where you can afford it. I bought some shirts a while back at Walmart, a whole series of very nice shirts for $5 and $6 a piece, which people, blue-collar, hardworking people who don't make a lot of money, people making minimum wage, can afford to buy a $5 shirt. If that $5 shirt isn't available anymore, or if the price goes to $10, a lot of people won't buy those shirts, which means Walmart won't make as much profit, which means that the wholesaler who sells them won't make profit. And it starts to echo down through the system where profitability starts to be lost and earnings start to fall, which causes the stock market to fall, which causes people to start hoarding money, which means they spend less, which means people start getting laid off. And I, by the way, think we may be on the verge of seeing that occur right now. But the price of oil declined. And it didn't decline because of an easing in the Persian Gulf. It didn't decline because of any geopolitical issue. It declined because the demand for oil is falling. Why is the demand for oil globally falling? Because we have a global recession cranking up. Germany is either in recession or right on the verge of it. The whole European Union is. The European Central Bank has started quantitative easing again. In other words, they are literally going out and buying bonds again to try to flush money into the system to keep the system operating above recession levels. And it's really questionable whether they're going to be able to do that. Several of the nations in the European Union, probably Germany, which is the biggest contributor to the GDP of the European Union, is probably in recession. We are about a month away from what appears to be Britain's, the United Kingdom's, very unruly exit from the European Union. Admittedly, something could happen. The Prime Minister would have to go to the European Union and say, please give us an extension. He has sworn he won't. The Parliament has said have passed a law, in essence, that says we won't leave the European Union without a deal. But if the British Prime Minister does not go along with that and he goes and doesn't negotiate a deal, then on October 31st, they are out of the European Union. That will be an economic blow. Nobody really has seen this happen before, so we don't know how big a blow it's going to be. But the trade agreements that Britain has with the rest of the world are all through the European Union, with a couple of minor exceptions. And suddenly they won't have a trade agreement with anybody, almost. There's a couple places that they've brokered trade deals with. They won't have any trade deals with the United States. All our trade deals with Britain are through the European Union. Suddenly we won't have any agreements on trade, and they will be subject to some very high tariffs that people who don't have agreements with us are subject to. And it's good to remember, and I don't think this is going to happen this time. This shows no evidence of happening, that the recession that began in the early events were in 1929 and into 1930 turned into a depression primarily because of tariffs. Tariffs designed to protect jobs in the United States, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, were the leading culprit, which Herbert Hoover signed into law. And he's now held in infamy. And textbooks don't have nice things to say about him and say he basically brought upon us the Great Depression. And they did so by tariffs. Now, do I think that's about to happen again? No, because we have a lot of factors in there, some of which we saw exercised during the week, that would prevent that type of thing from happening again. Again, the telephone number in here, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Now, to roll on into the economy itself. On Friday, the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economic Analysis at the Commerce Department, which I really think if I were going to work for the government, I would want to work for the Bureau of Economic Analysis. I've never seen the place, never met anybody from there, but it sounds like a cool place. I can just see floors covered with people with green eye shades sitting there crunching numbers and doing economic analysis all day long. I enjoy doing economic analysis, which shows that I'm a little perverted. And I can see a whole bureaucracy of people doing nothing but economic analysis, and that sounds like a lot of fun to me. But they announced that set off some alarm bells. They announced something that set off alarm bells. Didn't make headlines. And again, I want you to remember that about 70% of the U.S. economy is consumer expenditures. Now, a lot of people don't like that. A lot of people think we should be in manufacturing and we should be have a big manufacturing job base and a big manufacturing presence. It's an important thing to remember is we actually manufacture a lot more goods than we have ever manufactured before in history. Now, we're down like 1.7% from where we were a year ago, but we're down 1.7% from an all-time record. The manufacturing capacity and the manufacturing in the United States has grown amazingly over the last 50 years and 100 years. And it continues up until about a year ago, like everything else, it continued to grow. Now, what it doesn't do very much anymore is employ people. Because even as the U.S. manufacturing base has continued to grow and grow very fast, it has employed fewer and fewer and fewer people. And why is that? We're going to get into that a little bit if we have enough time today. Why there's a big strike at GM. One of the biggest reasons there's a strike at GM is because GM is becoming more cost effective. It's increasing its productivity and it's switching over to electric cars. And in doing so, the article in the Wall Street Journal said it very, very well. That there's a factory that previously had employed 20,000 people. Now employs 4,000. And it makes just as many cars. So that's a huge decrease in jobs while they're making more cars now than they were when they had 20,000 people working there. It's just that it is far, far, far more automated. And we're going to see a lot of that. And that is a big issue in society today. But it is nothing. I mean, it is extremely minor compared with what we're going to see as we go into this, what I think is going to be a recession probably in 2020, and as we move forward in this downturn, you're going to see workers replaced by automation on a wholesale basis. Is that bad or is that good? Actually, it's good because it's the only way we're going to remain competitive in the world. It's going to be bad if you happen to be an assembly line worker doing the same thing over and over again that can be done by a machine. Within the next decade on the outside and probably sooner, it will be done by a machine. Basically, anything you do that's boring, if you do the same thing over and over again and it's boring, your job is at risk because you can be replaced by a computer. I mean, how many people work in here? How many people are working in this? How many stations are here? Five? Four. There's four radio stations in this building we're in here. And how many people are actually employed in here today working? Three? Okay. It used to take two people minimum to operate a radio station plus a sales staff. So we got four radio stations in this building. That means there would have to be probably 10 people in here on a Saturday running this thing, and there's two or three in here being paid today, probably very low wages. And believe me, when I was started in radio back in the 1960s, one of the draws was the fact that if you were a named radio show host, and whether it was music or news, or we didn't have a lot of talk radio at the time, but whatever it was the show was about, you got a very good wage. And I looked at the people who I was working with at the time, whose names, by the way, never their real names, were attached to a show, and I looked at the fact that they had a wife and kids, and they were sending their kids to college, and they had a nice house, and I thought, man, that's what I want to do with my life. And automation has taken that away. Probably two or three of the radio stations here, there's nobody there. Yeah, I'm asking the engineer who's nodding his head vigorously. There's literally nobody at the radio station because it's all done by computer. And that's just the reality of the way the world is going and going there at an accelerating rate. That is going to change society dramatically. And I've got a pretty good feel for how it's going to happen because it happened almost exactly 100 years ago, exactly the same way. And that is an important thing to understand if you're an investor, if you're a participant in society, if you're a retiree. It doesn't make any difference who you are. It's really good to understand what's going on in society. In some cases, you can maneuver to take advantage of it. In some cases, you can maneuver to keep from being damaged by it. But it's critical to understand it as we move forward. Ultimately, it's going to result in an economic boom in the United States very much like that of the 1920s. And don't let me run over time here. Do we have any more commercials to do? Okay. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis came out and said that, and remember that about 70% of the U.S. GDP is consumer expenditures. A lot of people would like us to spend more money manufacturing and be big exporters. Actually, that's a bad deal. We don't want to be major exporters. We actually are a major exporter. We produce something that we export in huge quantities that costs us next to nothing to manufacture and from which we get huge profits. It's called the dollar. Unlike gold, people think of money as being species gold or something. And when you have a net negative balance of trade for a long period of time, if it's gold that you're using for currency, then eventually you're going to run out of gold. But we have the ability to produce as many dollars as we need. That's what the Federal Reserve does. It is both quality control and the production of dollars. That's what they do at the Federal Reserve. They produce dollars. They don't print them. They don't have the mint does that, and such a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of American currency is actually in the form of paper or coins. They produce credit. Remember I told you earlier, currency in the world today is credit. They produce credit. That's what banks do. And they issue it all around the world. And that's what the Treasury securities are about, and that's what the Federal Reserve gets involved in setting short-term interest rates. And we export, for every dollar's worth of goods we import from someplace, we export $1. And people have said this to me, well, isn't it bad that a lot of people are holding our dollars out there? No. It's wonderful. If you want to be in a chronic state of anxiety, be in a position where nobody holds your currency. Nobody loses anything if they attack your currency. That has happened to countries and they've collapsed. Nobody held rubles to speak of outside of Russia in 1998 when the ruble collapsed to nothing. If the ruble had been the dominant currency in the world, nobody would have allowed the ruble to collapse. All of the nations of the world and all the central banks would have united to support it because they held a lot of rubles in their bank accounts. The Russian ruble collapsed. Why? Because nobody held it except the Russians. Why did nobody hold it except the Russians? Because they were really, really busy prohibiting other people from holding their money. The Chinese are playing that game now. And it will probably not end well for them because of that. The dollar is what we export. Chinese economy, and we've said this before, is based on dollars. Is it in their best interest to collapse the dollar? Absolutely not. They pay for raw materials using dollars. They don't use euros. They don't use rubles. They may use a few euros, but mostly what they use is dollars. And they sell stuff to us. They make a profit. They gather dollars, and they use it to buy raw materials with. If the dollar were to collapse, let's just say the Chinese, as some people have suggested, suddenly sold all their treasury securities and caused the dollar to collapse by 50%. What would it do? It would destroy China. Why would it destroy China? Well, because they sell things to us, and that means everything they make in China would suddenly become twice as expensive for Americans to buy, which means we'd stop buying things from China, which means a lot of people in China would be out of work. The backside of that is when they buy iron ore, where they buy lumber, when they buy any raw material like oil that they need, they use dollars to buy it with, and if the value of the dollar drops by 50%, suddenly the price of everything they have to purchase doubled, and the price of everything they have to sell was cut in half, which would collapse their economy and cause their government to fail. So it's in the Chinese best interest to protect the value of the dollar. They've actually done a pretty good job of it, as a matter of fact. And they want to continue to protect the value of the dollar because their currency, their economy, is based on dollar reserves. Okay, we're about out of time for this first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach today on September 28th, 2019. And I want to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach also manages, is not just a radio show, it also manages money for relatively high net worth investors out of our offices in Salado, Texas. And if you'd like to give us a call and ask and talk to us about whatever you want to talk about off the air, you can call us at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 254-947-1111 or 1-800-9-800. Just call us at 254-947-1111. Or you can go to thepersonalwealthcoach.com and get see us. You can write us at Jeff or Jake at thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and we'll be back next hour with more of The Personal Wealth Coach.